Good evening. Before I formally introduce the speaker, we are happy to share with you the information that Dr. Shakuntala Narasimhan, who is a senior associate of NIAS, recently awarded a doctorate degree by the Pacific Western University, United States. This was in recognition of her work on women's studies. I congratulate her on behalf of NIAS faculty and associates for this distinction. Dr. Shakuntala Narasimhan was one of the participants of recent World Conference on Women at Beijing. Today she will be speaking on Learning from Beijing, Perceptions of Women Worldwide. Dr. Shakuntala Narasimhan obtained her master's degree in economics and did 2 years of research in development economics before shifting her focus to women and development. As I mentioned, she has a PhD in sociology with specialization in women's studies. She taught a course on women and development in USA on a Fulbright assignment in 1990 and has served as guest faculty for the postgraduate course in women's studies at Bangalore University. As journalist, she has published over 1,400 articles and 7 books and won the Media Foundation Award as Outstanding Women Journalist of the Year in 1984. She has taught journalism as guest faculty and was assistant editor with the Times of India Group, Bombay till 1984. She is also an acclaimed classical musician with 10 gold medals and an advanced degree with double distinction in musicology. She is the only vocalist in the country featured as top grade artist in the national program of music of All India Radio as well as Doordarshan, in both Carnatic and Hindustani style. As an activist, she received Government of India National Award for Consumer Protection in 1994 and was elected Vice President, Consumer Guidance Society of India for the 2 years from 1989 to 1990. She is a governing body member of the Consumer Education and Research Center, Ahmedabad, member of the State Committee for Gender Sensitization in school syllabus in Karnataka, member of the Music Edition Board of AIR Bangalore, and executive committee member Indian Musicological Society Baroda. Dr. Shakuntala Narasimhan now spends her time in writing, traveling on assignments, and teaching music. For today's program, I request Ms. Rilata Batliwala, research leader, Women's Policy Research and Advocacy Unit NIAS, to chair the session. She was also one of the participants of recent World Conference on Women at Beijing. Ladies and gentlemen, may I now invite Dr. Shakuntala Narasimhan to deliver her talk.
Members of the faculty of NIAS, ladies and gentlemen, I am delighted to be here this evening and I am thankful to the Institute for inviting me to speak on what we have learned from the Beijing Conference, which was held recently, on women's issues. I do have a prepared paper to ensure that I have my thoughts cogently worked out and I don't leave out any points that I would have liked to mention. At the same time, I would rather speak extempore because it's more spontaneous. But I'm hoping that once I finish what I have to say, there will be a question-answer session so that I can give you exactly what you want, any kind of information, clarification, etc. My participation in this conference at Beijing was as an accredited media representative, as a journalist, which means I had access to both conferences. There were two conferences held simultaneously. One was the NGO Forum, the conference of NGOs from all over the world, which drew something like 33,000 women from different countries, different parts of the world. And the other conference at Beijing proper, where there were something like 3,000 delegates. They were all official delegates sent by their respective governments, representing 183 countries. And the marvelous thing about my participation was that, unlike some of the other delegates, I stayed at Huairu, which was the venue for the NGO conference. Most of the NGO people stayed there. Most of these 33,000 women stayed there. Which meant we not only attended sessions, but we lived together for those 16, 18 days. At the same time, I was commuting to Beijing and back every day to attend the official sessions. So I got earfuls of both, the official versions and what the NGOs had to say, etc. And that was the best part. And I think this double exposure meant that I learned much more than I could have learned if I had gone as a representative for women's group. And I would like to mention very briefly some of the lessons that I can think of as I look back on the conference. What was it that I assimilated? What was it that struck me as a lesson? What was it that we learned not to do as Indians participating in the conference? As I said, there will be time for questions at the end of my presentation. There was a lot of media coverage for this conference. Many of you might have read not only the daily versions in the newspapers filed by various UNI, PTI, etc., but also the longer pieces that many of us wrote when we came back. Perhaps many of you also. As I said, I don't want to repeat the usual things that got reported in the press. What I'm trying to do is to look back on my personal reactions and perceptions when I look back on those 16 days which I spent at Huairu and at Beijing. In particular, unrecorded and intangible lessons that the conference brought to me personally, and to most of the participants, the Indians, the other participants. As I said, I'm not going to read, but I hope to be able to cover most of the points that I have jotted down. I start with my personal reactions as an individual participant. But at the same time, I must emphasize that these are not reactions that were unique to me. Many of us came back with the same kind of reactions, so I think they are valid. I start with those. I find that when I try to think back on what we learned from the conference, I can distinguish three different kinds of lessons that we learned. One was the marvelous exposure to such a big crowd, the largest ever gathering, 33,000 women from 183 countries, living together, eating together, traveling on the bus together, talking together, exchanging notes, conducting workshops, attending to each other's presentations, asking questions, sharing apartments. That itself was a marvelous experience in terms of proximity, in terms of participation. For example, I had never even heard of Cook Island. I had heard of Papua New Guinea, but I wasn't very sure where it was. And even if I was sure where it was, I had practically no idea what the people were like. What do the women wear? What do they eat? What do they sing? What is their language? What is their perception? What is their life like? I had no idea. And this was one of the first very tangible and very stark perceptions that we assimilated the moment we reached there. These different kinds. Actually, I have brought a set of photographs. Unfortunately, they're not slides, so I cannot project them. And I don't know how effective photographs can be. But I have these memories of different groups arriving in native costume, in particular the African groups. And as I said, this Papua New Guinea, I do have a picture in those grass skirts, feathers, and very typically, you know, ethnic jewelry, handicrafts, musical instruments, footwear, language, headdress, interacting with them. Where are you from? What language are you speaking? What is the problem that you are going to talk about? What is life like for a woman in your country? I mean, this was a marvelous lesson by itself, whether I attended the workshops or not. Just that 1 hour ride each way from Gwari to Beijing and back every day. We had to go in buses because there was a distance of 53 kilometers separating the two venues. In the beginning, we all grumbled about that. We said, maybe this is an official strategy to keep the NGOs out of the official conference. But I found that even that bus trip that we took, every trip I would find a different country woman sitting next to me. And then you can't spend an hour just staring straight ahead. So we would start talking. And we learned a lot that way. By the end, by the time we reached Beijing, I learned where Cook Island was, what language they spoke, what were their main priorities in terms of agendas for women, what they sing about, do they own land, what are the legal rights, what are the personal laws, whatever. We would keep chatting, we would keep talking, singing, etc. That was one huge lesson that I could not have ever got from any kind of encyclopedia, any kind of study or course or whatever, that interaction. I also feel that this conference was very, very unique in the sense that it was different from other international conferences. Maybe you have an international conference of mathematicians, physicists or whatever. But in this conference, the participants were the topic. The participants were the subject. We were not there as specialists in something and then going to the lectern and talking about our work or our research or our paper or whatever. We were talking about our own lives. So it was not just the workshops that was an exposure. It was the coming together itself. The conference was about us, about the participants. And we were the subject as well as the participants. That itself, I thought, made it very unique in one sense. We also learned a lot in the sense that, for example, Pakistan is our neighbor. Not only neighbor, we were the part of the same country 50 years ago. So we have the same heritage, the same background, same language, etc., customs maybe. What is it like for women now today, 50 years later, after they became a separate country? Have they progressed along the same lines as Indian women? Are they different? And if they are different, in what way? We don't know. How many of us have bothered really to look next door? We go abroad, maybe to America, to Australia, and then write very esoteric papers on specific issues, violence in the Ukraine or whatever. But here was Pakistan. I knew very little personally about Pakistani women. It was fascinating to spend time on the bus talking to them, attending their workshops. What about Middle Eastern women? We have these stereotype perceptions that Middle Eastern women are all heavily veiled, segregated, etc. Part of it is true, of course. But what is life really like for them? And can we club them all together as Middle East, like one group? Like when I go and teach abroad about women's issues in India, I have American students standing up and saying, would you be representative of Indian woman? Or they would say, talk about Indian woman. Which Indian woman do I talk about? Am I representative? Is Bhavari Devi representative or the servant maid who comes to work in my house or Indira Gandhi? We are all Indian women. So, and our lives are as different as it can be. So there is no single Indian woman one can talk about. You cannot generalize. In exactly the same way, when we think of Middle Eastern women, is there a range? Is there diversity? This was another lesson I learned because one of the friends I made was from Yemen. I knew practically nothing about Yemen. I had no idea how many women are educated, how many women are academics, what they are allowed to do, what they are not allowed to do, etc. And it was absolutely fascinating to talk to this delegate from Yemen and learn about not only women's issues, but that enthused me to look into the history. I didn't know when Yemen split up, what it came from. So in the process of participating, we learned a little bit of history, a little bit of geography, a little bit of politics. What is the political background in Yemen? One whole bus ride, this girl sat next to me and told me, explained to me how it came about, what are the political issues, how it they affect women, etc. So this was a learning process that went on 25 hours a day. That was another marvelous bonus, apart from the sessions, workshops, etc. As I said, this kind of friends we made, they exposed us to the history of these different regions, their politics, their culture, their food, their dress, their codes, their academic issues, besides the position of women in that country. And this kind of interactive learning was one of the marvelous experiences of Beijing. And I was particularly fortunate in that I stayed not in Beijing but in Huaru, where most of the NGO participants stayed. You stay in 3-star, 5-star, 4-star hotels. Anywhere in the world, you can wake up and not know where you are. They have exactly the same kind of breakfast, right from cornflakes onward, the same kind of facilities, the same kind of furnishings, etc. There is an uniformity that doesn't make any difference whether you are in China or in South America or whatever. Staying in Huaru was a bonus in the sense that we were in China. Whereas many of the delegates who stayed in some of these comfortable, expensive hotels in Beijing, they said it made no difference. I mean, they did not get the kind of exposure to China that they would have liked to have. Because you go from the convention center, you walk through an air-conditioned corridor and go from your room to the convention center and come back. And you have the same kind of food that you could have anywhere else in the world. So Huaru was different because this was a complex built entirely for the conference. Apartment blocks, like we had the Asiad village. They built up apartments which had been, I suspect, finished the day before we all arrived because the cement was still wet. And we could see these 10,000 of the 100,000 volunteers, high school children who were volunteers to help us. They were all over the place. Each apartment had 6 or 7 doing duty round the clock. And watching them, talking to them, that was another kind of learning. I mean, this was all marvelous exposure. The other aspect of the lessons of Beijing was the actual workshops. Apart from interacting, the kind of exposure we received in the 3,000 odd workshops that went on at Huaru and the plenary sessions in Beijing. Various subjects, anything at all from violence against women to legal remedies, how to raise credit for women's issues, training programs, success stories, whatever. We could choose what we wanted to. And tick it off and go and attend those sessions. And we got a lot of information in this sense. And every country had brought tons and tons of literature, statistics, what is the percentage of literacy in their country, how many are in academics, how many have tenured jobs, how many are scientists, what is the percentage in parliament, etc. Hard statistics, which we could collect and use whenever we wanted for our reference. Apart from that, listening to all these plenaries, listening to the speeches, the workshops, the discussions, even at Beijing, even in the official conference, the kind of discussions that went on before they could arrive at a consensus on the final document. That was also very interesting, and we learnt a lot through these discussions, the workshops, the draft country papers that were brought from different countries by their ambassadors, ministers, etc. When I look back on these two different kinds of learning that I have just mentioned now, what strikes me is that the first point I mentioned highlighted diversity. We were so diverse. We dressed differently. We speak differently. We moved differently. We sat differently. Our customs were different. Language different. Food was different. We looked different. The second issue, when we sat through the workshops, we saw that it was not the diversity, but the commonality, which was highlighted. And this was a very, very stark revelation. I learned that you can have diversity on the one hand, and still cutting through all that diversity was the basic things we were all talking about. Whether we were speaking in French or Egyptian, Russian, Arabic or English, we were all, most of us, we could reduce what we were saying to certain basic issues, for example, violence against women. So many people with diverse backgrounds, they all came and they spoke about violence, domestic violence in particular against women, as one of the priority issues. And this was a very stark lesson that not just me, but all of us picked up there. We are aware of the problem of domestic violence in India. We are aware that it happens in other countries. But to sit in a group of maybe 50, 60 different countries and then to hear them saying the same things in different languages with simultaneous translation, that sort of widened our perspectives. It said we are all basic. That was the whole point in having a conference. The common thing we had among us, in spite of all the diversity, was that we were all women. That gender commonality. And as women, we were exposed to certain things, like violence. I'm just mentioning that. There were other things mentioned. The astonishing thing that came out of this conference for the participating NGOs was that violence cuts through not only different cultures, but even income groups. For example, during one session, I had an Australian sitting with me, and Australia is one of the highest per capita incomes in the world. And Australia also has one of the highest incidences of violence against women. So we usually think of violence against women as something that the poor slum man who is an alcoholic, he gets drunk because he's frustrated, he comes home and beats his wife. You connect violence with poverty. This shows that it is not income, it's not even culture, it's not geography, it's something else. This was a real, at the core, it was a gender issue. Why do men beat? At all levels, at all income groups. What reason? And that helped us explore further. We listened to each other saying, this is the reason in our country. This is what our group find out. This is what we think is happening in our culture. So this kind of widening of our perspectives on even issues that we were ourselves working on, that was also a bonus. It was a lesson that we learned. Apart from violence, the other thing I can think of is this problem of structural adjustment policies, how they affect women, is liberalization and the World Bank, IMF sponsored economic reforms that we have had in our country for the last 5 years. I have heard, before going to Beijing, I heard a lot of regional Indian women's groups, NGOs, especially from Kerala and Andhra Pradesh, talking about the adverse effects of structural adjustment programs on women, the fisherwomen, land-owning women, landless women in Andhra Pradesh, etc. It was something else again when we sat through a session, I sat through a session, where a woman from Africa, from Tanzania, she is a marginal farmer. And she stood up and she made a marvelous presentation on what structural adjustment policy had done to her. It was a case study. It was a true story. And we could learn from what had she done about it. How was she fighting it? How were women's groups in her country tackling this? Would she be representative? Would it apply to our situation? Can we learn anything? This kind of interactive learning was what all the workshops and all the sessions were about. Even those women who were already talking about problems like this, either violence or structural adjustment or whatever, they had their horizons widened. They acquired new perspectives through this interaction at the various sessions. Then there was another session in the context of violence, which I should have mentioned earlier. The question in this session was, why are women still being targeted as part of war crimes? For example, we had Mrs. Fanfani, the wife of the former president of Italy. She had led an investigating team. And she had a very, very interesting, hard-hitting report to give us on what exactly happens in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Nicaragua also. All these, how the political strife increases the incidence of rape, which is a very well-known feminist thing. The woman is punished as a possession of the man whom you want to punish. You conquer somebody and then you rape their women as part of the conquest. And how this has happened in Bosnia and Rwanda and Nicaragua, what they are doing about it, what can the UN do about it? In fact, the UN has just established a commission to investigate violence against women. And a Sri Lankan lady heads that commission. She had a very nice report to give us on the different manifestations of violence in different parts of the world, what her office is doing, what it can do, what it has been unable to do. That was a very nice lesson we received. At the same time, we also learned to victims, but we also heard the victims. For example, we have all read about the comfort women, the women who were forced to serve the Japanese soldiers during the war. We have heard reports in the newspapers. It was something else again when you actually sit face to face with one of those comfort women and listen to her experiences of 50 years ago. I mean, she puts a human dimension to it, and it becomes a problem in flesh and blood. It's different reading it in paper. It's completely different, absolutely different when you sit and actually listen to her, and then you can ask her questions. She answers questions from everybody. So it adds a human dimension to the problems that one only reads about in the papers. One more thing we all learned, many of us did learn, was tackling fundamentalist groups. The rise of fundamentalism can be seen in many areas of the world. Many of them try to hijack the proceedings at various conferences, political ends. And this happened very predictably at Beijing also. We had certain right-wing, extreme right-wing groups coming there and trying to, as I said, hijack the proceedings and get their views imposed. The interesting thing was, I sat through some of the official UN sessions where the minister or the ambassador would come and present his country report, in which he would say, we have made marvelous progress in our country. Arab women have contributed significantly to Arab culture and Arab economy, etc. And Norway and Sweden, for example, they said they topped the world listing. You must have heard about the Human Development Report, the latest one, which has a gender index. In terms of the gender index, that is, what is the status of women in their countries? In those terms, they have developed an index. One stands for absolute equality, the best situation for women. Zero is the worst. And Norway and Sweden come right on top of the table. Which was a marvelous thing, and of course the ambassador of Norway and Sweden, both of them, in their country papers, they said our women are doing much better than anywhere else, and we happen to have a law which allows fathers to take 1 year leave for looking after a child. Maternity leave, if you want to call it that, is available to the father. 1 year long leave, which means the mother is not forced to sit at home looking after the baby. The father can also share equality, etc. While I was listening to this country paper, the TV camera person sitting next to me was from Sweden, Swedish TV crew. She was sitting next to me. She was giving me a commentary, and what she had to say was completely different from what the ambassador was saying. Because this woman had left a 2-year-old baby with her husband back home. And she was telling me about the problem she had in even trying to make this trip. And her husband used to call late at night to say, how do I do this? The brat is crying. What do I do this? Where do you keep these drops? Whatever, whatever. So she was narrating all this. We were laughing over it. And then I asked her, what's your ambassador saying and why are you saying something different? She said something very, very perceptive, which applies all over the country, all over the world. She said, on paper, we have absolute equality, much better than in any other country. But in actual practice, you know, only 11% of fathers have taken this leave which they are entitled to. Only 11% of fathers who are eligible to take it have actually availed themselves of this child care leave. She says there is a lot of conservatism still lingering. You can't just wipe it away with by passing a law. Which is very true. It's applicable to everything. Dowry rates, for example. You pass a law, it hasn't made any difference. In fact, it has worsened it. So, apart from the country paper and the literature or whatever, in fact, I collected 42 kilos of literature. By the end of the conference, at the end of 16 days, I had 42 kilos and I had to dump 21 kilos because the airline would not let me bring more than 21 kilos. So, that was the amount of material we collected. That was completely different from
what we learned from personal interactions, listening, asking questions, mingling, living with those women, because we got two different versions from that same countries also. There was one session where I remember a very, very high-sounding medical doctor as head of a very, very, again, high-sounding institute for Islamic studies or something like that. He made himself available for all the journalists for press interviews for 3 whole days. He had plastered the whole press complex with his press handout, 3-page handout, where he said, what the conference is doing is actually anti-family and anti-God. They are by asking for a draft which will promote women's rights to choice and reproductive decisions. That was very much part of the agenda. And this, he, after saying this, he says, I praise the women delegates from the Middle Eastern countries like Jordan and Sudan for asserting their rights to put religion before human rights. And this was another very fascinating lesson I learned. I think I'm going to run out of time at this rate, but never mind. What happened was we had a lot of delegates from the Middle Eastern countries, from the Muslim countries, Arab countries, heavily veiled, etc. As a journalist, when I went around asking questions, it was very interesting to see that many of these delegations had women, but they were controlled by a man. A man was part of the delegation. And any time any journalist came to talk to them or ask any questions, it was the man who would answer. The women were not allowed to open their mouths. I was told that it's because of language, but I'm not very sure. Because most of them, I found them reading the handouts, which are in English. They were not allowed to speak. And then actually one woman got up during one of these sessions and screamed at the French chairperson of that session for saying that France has recently passed a law which forbids schoolgirls from veiling themselves. High school girls cannot wear the veil during school hours. She said, you are attacking our culture. You are taking our right to wear the veil. That was one way of looking at it. Was she being made to say it? Was she saying it willingly? Had she been brainwashed into saying it? Or do women themselves feel this way? Is it really a assertion of individuals' rights? Where do you draw the line? It's like saying you take away my right to commit sati by passing a law. It's exactly the same. So we found these marvelous parallels, marvelous maybe the wrong word, gruesome parallels maybe, across different cultures. That was another lesson I learned, because no amount of reading about these different cultures or countries could have exposed us to this kind of, you know, real information. You get information even when the women don't open their mouths. Just their presence, their reactions or non-reactions. They were all lessons, all the time. So, and by participating in this kind of sessions, it provided us in the sense of even NGOs, an important lesson in how fundamentalist groups work, their strategies, and how to tackle them by sifting the grains of religion from those of fanaticism. How do they work? What strategies do they employ? This was another thing I learned. The conference was supposed to be... Well, I was talking about fundamentalism. I said, by watching these fundamentalist groups during the workshops, their arguments, the way they answered the press, their handouts, etc., we learned something about the strategies that these fundamentalist right-wing groups employ. Do they work through the women or on their own? Do they co-opt the women? Do they attack the women? They do both, of course, in different contexts. How they do it, why they do it, how can we circumvent it, how can we bypass it or find it. Anti-family. Because there was a lot of heated discussion about do we mean a conventional family or don't we? Some of these, the other extreme. They, you know, the gays, the gay groups and also. They said by family, it could also be 2 men, 2 women or whatever. and the Vatican came in for a lot of flak, etc. I tried to steer clear of political, attacks to and fro crossfire, but it was still a lesson to watch the two extreme groups, what they say, how they maneuver the proceedings in order to be able to say something. You know, there will be a question on something else. They would pick on one word and steer it and mold it in such a way and fashion another question so that they come to the topic that they want to put on record. These were all tactics that we ought to know if we are going to be able to deal with fundamentalist groups, fanatics or whatever. So that was another lesson that a lot of NGOs said they learnt. I have already mentioned the Human Development Report, there is a huge gap between paper professions and reality. That was one of the constant recurring lessons that I got. The third category of lessons that many of us learned was about how others perceive us. How do other countries look upon India? How important was it for them to make time to attend sessions by Indian NGOs, listen to Indian speakers? How aware are they of our problems? How do they perceive us? We know how we perceive us, what our priorities are, what our problems, issues are, etc. For example, dowry debts. Very predictably, a lot of them Westerners came and asked, why do you burn brides in your country? I found that there are no straight answers to their questions as well as the counter questions we could raise, because I found that the media has played and will always play a very strong role. For example, one article in the Washington Post or the New York Times, it will say today is Akka Teej, 3,000 one-year-old children will be married off, etc., etc. And they have this perception that married off means what? They start living as man and wife, whatever. And there will be this picture of a 10-month-old baby doing the pheras in its mother's hands or whatever. I remember that one of my own articles on dowry deaths, I did a piece on dowry deaths because about 2 years ago, this group Vimochana in Bangalore, they were getting one dowry harassment case every single day. Every single day there was one case. And this was just the tip of the iceberg, because for every case you hear, there are four or five more which you don't never get to hear about. So it was getting very alarming. At that time, I did a story on, is it connected to Bangalore's rise, sudden explosion as a megacity or whatever, Maruti culture, incomes, multinational entry, whatever. This story in the Hindustan Times was picked up by the New York Times correspondent, who flew down from Delhi to Bangalore, talked to a few women here, went back and filed a very, very biased and very a piece based on preconceived ideas that women are all burnt automatically or whatever. There was no attempt to go into the cultural backgrounds or the problems, why the law hasn't worked, why it happens, persists, etc. So when people asked us questions, we got lessons on how others perceive us also. How many people come to ask questions in our sessions? My feeling was that the Indian presence, in terms of numbers, it was very large. Almost every sixth or seventh woman seemed to be in a sari or a salwar kameez. You could see them all over the place. But in terms of articulation, in terms of impact, I thought we really let a very good chance go by default. Because, for example, compared to the Africans, the African women, they may be very poor, they may be illiterate, they may be really having a lot of problems, political, economic, social, all kinds of problems. But they came marvelously prepared for this conference. And they really spotlighted themselves by doing their homework, coming prepared with all kinds of activities, a play, a song, a good speech, case histories, pamphlets, etc. Whereas 3 days after our delegation went there, maybe Srilatha will know, the Indian delegations got together at 9 o'clock. They put up a notice and said, we have to do something. What shall we do? Shall we have a music session? Shall we have an entertainment? Who can do what? You know, 3 days after the start of the conference, some African countries had even gone to the extent of getting special that emblem of that conference with a dove and all that. They had it printed on few hundred meters of cloth, very colorfully. And all the delegates wore only that, even the men. They had scarves of that cloth, and it was one way of hitting the eye, one way of drawing attention, because it makes people curious. I naturally wanted to know, why are you all wearing the same thing? What does it mean? How did you get it made? Do you usually wear this kind of... It was a conversation starter. It was an icebreaker. And it was one way of hitting the eye, like putting up posters. That way, I thought the Indian presence, we did learn a lesson that you need to do a lot of homework. You really need to work ahead. We did, of course. There's no question that we did. We had a lot of state level, regional, national level meetings on issues. But there was this gap which I could see thereafter going. In fact, some of the Indian groups had very lovely scrolls with very ethnic Indian paintings and things, calendars and scrolls. They went begging because nobody knew they were available there. Whereas other countries, they did their publicity work very well. It was a package, so they hit the eye. They made sure that people attended their sessions, or whether it was Yemen or Algeria or whatever. That I think we let go by default. There was a lot of talk about female feticide, infanticide. As I said, like dowry deaths, that's another story that the Western media likes to project. They kill girl babies in Madras, near Madurai. Makes a big splash. And I think in that sense, media persons often get carried away. They become voyeurs. They lose. I mean, the accent is on masala. I want a sensational story, sensationalizing everything. So our presence there helped to counteract this in some way, because hopefully a woman who sat next to me on an hour-long bus ride would get a different kind of picture talking to me. She would ask me, are you a daughter-in-law? Do you have a daughter-in-law? Are you educated? Would you be representative? How many women would be like you? Would they dress like you? Would they travel abroad? What about your children? Etc. etc. All these question answer sessions. I keep saying women, but we must remember that they were also 1,500 men delegates in the conference. That was a large number. And there were the usual jokes. All the media people will converge on them saying, ha-ha, how does it feel to be surrounded by so many women? Don't you feel out of place? Etc. etc. And some of the men did get very furious because they were very serious. Some of them had very nice answers. They said, we are interested. We are part of the same society. I want to understand. And by sitting through all our sessions, they understood what we were talking about. They wanted to hear us say it in our own words. As I said, the African present was in terms of numbers very small. Just 3,245 from the entire African continent. Whereas from Asia and the Pacific region, there were 12,331, four times. And still they made their impact. That was one lesson that I personally learned and many NGOs learned. A lot of our sessions had a poor attendance because people didn't know. Even those who would have been interested to attend some of our sessions afterwards said, oh, I didn't know there was going to be such a session. I didn't know it was going to take place. Partly it was also the confusion of changing venues, etc., etc. There was just too much going on. Simultaneously, 50 workshops going on, so you get carried away, you miss something or whatever. The other thing, do I have 5 more minutes? Or, well, 5-10 minutes, yeah? One more lesson we learned was by sitting through some of these success stories. Actual women who have done something, you know, fought against a law, change the law against land ownership maybe, or as I said, structural adjustment, herbal remedies, how have they used in their own countries for medical issues, health issues, for contraception, for anemia, whatever. Somebody has done something in Guatemala, somebody has done something in Latin American countries, somebody has done something in Karnataka. A girl from Karnataka had a session on herbal remedies for common women's ailments. And there was a lot of interest and interaction. There were a lot of questions. So we learnt a lot. And by hearing these success stories, a lot of NGOs have gone back saying, can we duplicate it? They were asking, what is this turmeric? Can it grow in other climates? Does it need heat? Does it need this kind of water? Can it grow in a desert? What does it look like? Can I carry back some? What is a botanical name? What is this grass? You know, we were trying to share information and enrich and thereby empower ourselves. There were some reports which called the entire conference an expensive jamboree, just another massive exercise in talking and doing nothing. Maybe in one sense, I would say that's partly true of the UN, the official conference, but not of the NGO conference, because the accent there was on doing, not talking. Everyone got down to doing something. And even in the UN conference, I have these marvelous memories of Carol Bellamy, who heads the UNICEF, getting up and doing a very nice session where she, for example, put it very nicely. She said, UNICEF is for children, okay? You need so many billions for primary education, for ensuring that infant mortality rates are brought down, etc. She said, the world spends $85 billion on wine per year, on wine consumption, $400 billion on cigarettes, $250 billion on advertising, $40 billion on golf. Okay? And then it takes $9 billion to provide safe drinking water and sanitation for the entire world, for the entire world's population. And only $6 billion for providing primary education for all the children of the world. If she had $6 billion, she says, she could ensure primary education for all the children. Whereas $40 million goes on golf, $400 billion on advertising, wine, etc. Okay? $13 billion would provide basic child health care and nutrition. The contrast was very, very stark and very significant, because these were petty amounts when compared to 400 and 250 billion. Then she comes down to 6 billion, 9 million, 13 billion, 12 billion. So I said, my God, this is something we can do. And that was a good lesson, that whole session, on it, the fact that it's not resource crunch that is the problem. It is a lack of political will. There is a lot of money. And I agree with this entirely, because even in India, I don't think money is the real crunch. You see the amount of money that's flowing. The number of Maruti. I live across the road from Lassi Bar, where you get kulfi, lassi. Local civic group or whatever they will say. No. So it's not the research kind, it's the unwillingness to get involved. We progressed from Copenhagen, Mexico, Nairobi to Beijing. Step by step, because in the beginning the whole thing was considered a bit of a joke. What can you talk about women's issues? Local civic group or whatever they will say. No. So it's not the research kind, it's the unwillingness to get involved. We progressed from Copenhagen, Mexico, Nairobi to Beijing step by step, because in the beginning the whole thing was considered a bit of a joke. What can you talk about women's issues? Then by Mexico and then by Nairobi, it became validated. But here is, by the time they reached Beijing, they said, we are not just going to talk action, not words. That was what Mongela herself said. Before I conclude, I must mention one more lesson that we learned from the Beijing experience, which was about China itself. We learned about ourselves, we learned about other countries, but what about the host country? I was there for about 16 days. Because of the bamboo curtain, we haven't had so much information outside compared to other countries on what life is really like for women, especially in the past 50 years or so. So I was personally very, very curious. And 18 months before I went to the conference, I had started my homework. I read up a lot. I started a file. I made a clippings collection. I got some background on their culture, language, script, history, women's status, etc. But I still wanted to meet a lot of women, activists, etc. The Chinese government said no. They specifically said, my visa has been issued only for reportage on the conference. I am not to make any attempt to meet anyone outside the conference. I will not be allowed to. And I also remember that there were a lot of field trips that were put up for the delegates. And anyone who had a press card dangling from her neck was not allowed. No, ma'am, sorry. No, no seat. And one girl actually blurted out and said, sorry, we can't take journalists. So we had no interaction with the locals, which was very curious. That itself was a statement, was a lesson for me, because None of us know how many Chinese women participated in the conference as delegates. None of them opened their mouths. There was no discussion on their issues. But at the same time, when I said I'm interested, I was given kilos and kilos of pamphlets like this. Chinese women scientists, women in sports, women in political life, successful contemporary Chinese women. So I read these and then I said, I marked down names and said, so-and-so is in Beijing, so-and-so is 10 miles out of Beijing. Can I meet so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so? And the answer was no, you cannot meet anyone. We will give you these books, you can quote from them, we'll give you pictures if you want, but you cannot meet them. That itself was a comment on China, what happened. It's a beautiful country, beautiful culture. In fact, I was, it was a pity that we couldn't interact more because so something like what's happening in Narmada, they have a similar thing called the Three Gorges. It's going to be the world's biggest dam and they have activists protesting for the last 10 years. Exactly the same way. Several million hectares are going to be submerged. They want to tame the river. They say we need the power, etc., etc. There was a very significant parallel and I would have liked to investigate that. But unfortunately, the authorities made sure that we didn't go anywhere outside them. They were police cordons. And especially with the press card, I found it difficult. I was one of three media people who, on the sixth day, went to the UN and said, we want to register protest. And then I was told that that was not the right thing to do because then you may not be allowed to stay for the remaining 10 days or whatever. But things did improve after the sixth day. Some of the restrictions were removed. But this was the first time that I understood what we mean when we say democracy, when we say emergency, etc. Why are we making such a hala? I lived through the emergency, it made no difference to me. In fact, a lot of people say things were working on time, trains were running on time, post office used to work on time, for discipline it's good or whatever. It never occurred to me that what they were talking about was not this, but something different. And I felt that there. I remember standing in Tiananmen Square surrounded by policemen with machine guns and two steps in the wrong direction and you would be in trouble. So even to take pictures, I could feel it in my bones. It was an uncomfortable feeling. I was made to feel as if I was an intruder. It's something difficult to describe. So I said, this will not happen in my country, hopefully. So that was another lesson, what we learned about China. Of course, I read up a lot. I traveled a little. We all went to the Great Wall. And we were shown a lot of handicrafts. They put up a lot of stalls, etc. The last point I would like to very quickly make is that one lesson which came to me about Chinese life. There's a lot of correspondence. They have a lot of poverty. The per capita income is roughly the same, $300 to $350. In spite of that, you don't see the kind of filth, cleanliness. Community health is something they have marvelously progressed compared to us. Forever, I would stand in the balcony 5 o'clock in the morning and there would be these thousands of volunteers sweeping away, tying up garbage, putting it away. 7 o'clock in the night, they would still be sweeping. Forever. Cleanliness and sanitation, health and sanitation. And the other thing was frugality. Frugality. There are only 5,000 cars in Beijing, out of which you take away the diplomatic corps cars, and the pop singers, I believe, are allowed to own cars, and sports achievers are allowed to own cars. If you take them away, how many private owners are there? 5,000 cars in a city like Beijing? The streets are empty. How many Marutis do we have in India? In Bangalore, for example. That frugality, that sense of, you know, cutting down consciously or voluntarily, I don't want to go into the ideology part of it or the political part of it. But this is the only way maybe they could have managed. I don't know whether it's enforced or voluntary or sight or whatever. But this was very starkly. I wandered around a little, I tried to. And there is a different kind of poverty. I mean, the houses are very modest. They squat on the floor, the children dress the same way, but you don't see the kind of upsetting poverty. The filth, the rags, whatever, the the mutilated bodies or lepers and things like that. I don't know. And I thought maybe it's only because of the conference. But I spoke to Indians who have been there for 15, 20 years, permanent residents. And they confirmed the impression that I had got, that frugality is playing a very, very important part in the kind of progress that China has been able to make in spite of their 1.2 billion population and their low levels of income. Maybe there is a lesson somewhere here for us. As I said, apart from the political ideology that governs this or whatever, I think that's all I have time to mention. If you have any questions, I thank you all for listening to me.
Important lesson we have all learned over the years that you cannot tabulate things like that when you're dealing with women's issues. There is always cross-indexing or cross effects or whatever. Mythology you grow up with. Is it part of society? Is it part of training? Is it part of education? Is it part of domestic life, family life? Whatever. I mean, you cannot. So how can you separate the effect of mythology?
People at the back didn't hear it, I'm sure. And the gentleman once starts by saying that he comes from a very enlightened family. His mother was highly educated, and so were his sisters and his sisters-in-law. And yet, his mother did not have a very good relationship with her daughters-in-law. There was friction. And he... Yeah, and he wants to know whether this particular syndrome has improved or disappeared or gotten worse or whatever.
You want me to answer that question? I think it's related to lifestyle patterns. If you have a joint family, there's bound to be a friction. If you that itself eliminates part of the friction. And but in China, they still have three generations living under the roof. But as I said, they wouldn't talk. Even if I had been able to ask them, is there friction? I don't think they would have spoken. So that's one point I wanted to make. Otherwise, my personal perception from what I have learned as a journalist writing about women's issues is that we cannot generalize. It's very difficult to generalize. It depends on people. Some people get on marvelously, some people don't. Whether you are daughter and mother or mother-in-law and daughter, there can still be friction if you don't get along with each other.
That's a very friction between brothers, between father and son.
Indian delegation, before going, made up its mind very, very clearly that each delegate who attends the Beijing conference comes back will have to pass on all her enrichment to the group she is working with. I mean, she's just going as a representative. It's not personal enrichment. She will have to pass on whatever she has learned or gained to her group, which will then spread it. So that was very clearly specified understanding. And that was the understanding on which many of these very, very poor, grassroots workers, some of them even illiterate. Bhavari Devi was there. There were many who couldn't even speak proper Hindi from Rajasthan and UP, for example. Why were they there? Because they couldn't understand any of the five languages in which we had simultaneous translators. What was the point? The point was that somebody translated, and that, as I said, the intangible input she got. The point was that she is a grassroots worker and she will pass on whatever she has learned to the group. So specifically, we have said that action. And after coming back also, it was very heartening to see that the Indian group met again, had a thrashing out session, 3-day workshop, if I remember right, to say what have we brought back and what should we do now. So it is not just talking. I think this is the first time that so much emphasis has been put on action. They will come up with a replication of success or stories or spreading information, ideas. Multimedia exposures or awareness creation camps, different ways of training, different strategies. I think all that will be put to use. That's my feeling.
That is then
single biggest
I don't know, it would be very difficult to pick out what would you say. As I said, validation of women's issues that had already happened by the time of the Nairobi conference. And this time they said, we are not just going to stop with talking about validated questions, but what can we do about it? Not only that, the thrust constantly, as Srilata pointed out, especially at the NGO workshops, they kept hitting very hard saying, we are going to hold our government accountable. Some of the NGOs attended the plenary sessions of the official conference to monitor what the country representatives were saying and then to hold them accountable. I remember I was part of the group which met Madhavrao Sindhia after his presentation. He was the minister in charge at that time. He was the leader of our delegation. He made his presentation. Immediately afterwards, some 10 or 12 of us journalists, we were allowed to meet him. We sat with him and we caught on immediately. He said, you said you are going to change the pattern of the National Commission for Women. Do you have a time-bound program? Can you give us a date? Will it be next February? Will it be 97? Will it be 2000? Madhavrao had a very articulate answer. I mean, it was very revealing. He said, you know, personally, I'm 101% for women. I wish I could do everything I promised. But, you know, it depends on so many ministries, the finance ministry, for example. And tomorrow I may not be there after election. So it depends on my successor. That means what? So you have your answer there. So we a lot of NGOs, not only in India, many countries, they made it a point to monitor their official positions and to hold them accountable.
The lady at the back.
Yeah, I should put this off the record, so I don't know, maybe next time I won't get a visa. Anyway, I did put up the question to myself saying, why did they have it there? Point number one, prestige question. Point number two, I believe they asked for the Olympics and they didn't get it, so the UN said as a SOP, they were given this. Okay. The third thing was the economic aspect. They made money out of it.
And they wanted to show the world that their human
rights record is not bad. Yeah, it was propaganda. They milked it. It was good exposure.
They wanted to impress the world.
It was a controlled exposure. Instead of getting 35,000 tourists who may or may not spend this much money, in fact, in some way, they did do good PR work, because the way they were received, the 110 buses that were put at our disposal, taken in a convoy, which was all very impressive. So you, even if you came with some kind of adverse perceptions about communism or China or whatever, you were obliged to say, they did a good job. I remember a Kathak dance which was done by a Chinese girl. It was one of the best Kathak performances I've ever seen. They showed what they were capable of.
Dr. Sundra?
It goes all the way down to point top of the table with 0.79 or something, if I remember right. And bottom of the table is Afghanistan with 0.1 or something. They have given some explanation. I don't think I can quote.
They used four or five...
Number of women in parliament or in decision-making posts.
Percentage of women in parliament.
And
women's literacy.
Literacy and life expectation, maybe.
Life expectancy.
A few indices like this.
The report wasn't out at that time.
It was.
No, but just the draft version. The final hadn't yet come. It had just been sort of circulated in a very limited way.
To come up with a reality when you're dealing with human beings like this, especially in sociology, I'm very doubtful how valid you can treat indices in certain measurements. Maybe in certain areas it will work. But things like status of women. You can only say Scandinavian countries are better. Yeah. Even that,
as I said, you know, you talk to one woman and she says only 11% of the fathers have used it. So there is already a gap between what's on paper and what's the reality. Apart from that, even on paper, our country paper did a lovely job. Our Madhavrao Sindhya started off saying we have a long tradition of Shakti, Ardhanarishwara, Indira Gandhi, and then we passed so many laws in the last 40 years. There is no difference in pay scales, whatever. I mean, Equal Remuneration Act, Maternity Act, and then the biggest thing is medical termination of pregnancy. Yeah. Many countries are still fighting for that. It's illegal. A lot of people who listened to Bhavri Devi in Beijing, they were flabbergasted. They said, my God, you Indian women are very courageous for a illiterate, poor woman to go up till the Supreme Court like this to fight her case. Gang rape wouldn't have been possible in our country. In one way, maybe they're right too. There are two ways of looking at something. We are all talking about a half full glass. No country is absolutely full. And you can call it a half full or a half empty. Maybe the women are saying it's half empty, we want more. The governments are saying, look, we have filled half of it. So both can be truthful, and still there can be different perspectives.
Dr. Shimba? We should conclude now because I see a lot of thirsty and hungry faces. I can't resist making a few concluding remarks. I'll try to be very brief. I admire Shakuntala for having attempted to convey to you the feel of an experience which was almost beyond words. One of those cliches, I know, but you really had to be there to understand the most incredible explosion and overstimulation. When she spoke about the magnitude of the diversity of the exposure, there was a downside to it too, in a way, because every day I would see these very exhausted looking women sitting slumped in chairs. And when you sat next to them equally exhausted and said, what's the matter? Are you feeling okay? And she'd say, it's too much. It's too much. I can't understand it. So at one level, I don't think in a sense men have ever experienced a conference like this. There is no parallel, I think, that has ever been held, a world conference of men. But there was another aspect of it which showed, when we speak about the global village, that the world is shrinking, but somewhere within we are still villagers, and we find it very hard to grasp something that's so global and so vast. The question that was asked about what was the single most important outcome, I'm addressing this not just because it was asked by my husband, but because I think it is a very important statement to make at the end of such a delightful and thought-provoking presentation. And that is that what I think Beijing really proved or demonstrated was the coming of age and the consolidation of the women's movement worldwide. The sophistication, the sheer depth and breadth of knowledge, the expertise that has grown in this movement, the strength, the solidarity, yes, all the problems and all the mother-in-law, daughter-in-law syndromes as well. But in the words of a friend and colleague who spoke at one of the plenaries, I would like to use those words to conclude this talk. She said, listen, world, the women have arrived, they've come to stay, and they won't go away. Thank you.